You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. I'm Barbara Bogave. For the next 6 weeks, we're partnering with the BBC World Service for a special collaboration. It's called Six Routes to Riches, an in-depth look at the challenges and opportunities people face as they make a living. We're taking a tour of six countries at the heart of the changing global economy: Brazil, China, Germany, India, Nigeria, and the U.S. Lizzie is on assignment now in Brazil, and she's here to tell us more about what we can look forward to in the coming weeks. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Barbara.
So, fill us in. Why this series, and why now?
Well, I think there are a number of factors. So, first off is inequality, which is really kind of the issue of our time, this growing gap between rich and poor. There was this recent report out by Oxfam, and one of the numbers was staggering, which is more than half of the world's wealth will be controlled by 1% of the world's population. And what was almost as amazing was that it landed sort of without that much noise, that wasn't actually that surprising to that many people. And so we look at inequality, but then we also look at sort of the shadows of the global financial crisis, the recession that followed, and all of the after effects, the global middle class that was created by so much growth in places like India and China and Brazil, where I am now. And then what happens now? What happens to all of those dreams? How different countries make their way, and what sort of aspiration looks like in all of these different places? You know, what's similar and what's different?
And you mentioned India, China, Brazil. You mentioned some of the factors that caused you to look into those countries. But why those specific ones?
Well, I think they're a real diverse range. And then if you talk about Brazil, where I am now, the sort of rise of the middle class and the consumer class, you know, these countries represent very interesting and succinct lenses through which to look at different models of how to make it.
Thank you for checking in with us here.
Of course.
And today we get to make our first stop on the tour, Germany, a stalwart of the global economy. And now it's at the center of a debate about the economic future of Europe. Here's the BBC's Simon Jacks and Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
If you want to understand the engine that's been powering the German economy and its dominant role in the global economy for the last few decades, a good place to start would be this German factory in the center of Berlin, which makes actual engines, steel engines, that are actually powering the global economy.
Be careful, everything what seems to be dirty is usually dirty.
35-year-old Mathis Menzel, gelled blonde hair, scar on his nose, in a suit and purple suspenders, is the owner of this factory, and he's walking me through a workshop full of grease-coated parts and steel filings to show me some of these engines. They're about to be shipped out across the globe.
Let's have a look.
The one in that corner, he says, pointing to a couple of cream-colored motors the size of coffee tables.
These will go for Iranian cement plants.
Iranian cement plants.
Yeah.
And those motors over there, painted canary yellow.
These are for a refinery plant in Sweden, oil refinery.
And then there are the motors that will power gold mines in South America, rubber factories in Africa, car shredders in the Middle East.
You put a complete car in and you get just chips out of it, just steel chips. So that's eating a complete car. The machines have a weight of 35, 40 tons.
As the world's developing economies grow, the hunger grows for more car shredders and cement plants and rubber factories that are kept running thanks to motors, big and small, made right here in this factory that Mathis Menzel owns. Before that, Mathis's father owned it, and before that,
my grandfather,
who started the motor company in 1927. His grandfather's name, Kurt Menzel.
You'll see it's still on the building. It's painted still on the building there.
And in fact, the story of the Menzel family's electric motor factory is in many ways the story of the German economy for more than half a century. A story that's best told with a few of those awesome compound words that Germans love, starting with this word.
Mittelstand.
Mittelstand. Definition, a small to medium-sized family-owned company, often in manufacturing. Because as much as we hear about the big companies, the Mercedes and the BMWs of Germany, it's these Mittelstands, like Mathis Menzel's factory, that have been the driving force behind Germany's economy for a very long time. Which brings us to another special German word.
Wirtschaftswunder.
Wirtschaftswunder, which literally translates to economic miracle. That's what the Germans call the thing that happened to their country in the wake of World War II. But it wasn't exactly a miracle that transformed Germany from rubble into one of the strongest economies in the world, known for high wages, high productivity, and weeks of vacation for the average worker. Economists attribute the Wirtschaftswunder to a set of crucial interlocking economic principles, principles that you can see right here on the Menzel family's factory floor. Principle number one, invest in your workforce.
Moin.
Including the worker in the blue overalls that Mathis just said good morgen to.
This is Thomas Dobratz. He's since more than 30 years in the company.
Thomas Dobratz is a supervisor at the factory. He's worked here since Mathis Menzel was a little boy. In fact, the Dobratz family is almost as deeply rooted in the Menzel factory as the Menzels are themselves.
My father was here, and my uncle was here, and my brother was here.
This kind of long family relationship between factory and worker is really common in German industry, says Mathis Menzel.
It's a very usual way that people are working all their life in the same company.
And so you develop a relationship and...
One thing is, for sure, you develop a relationship, and on the other hand, they also do. They appreciate to learn things, they remember things. They don't do the same mistakes after 5 years again because they have remembered. There's a lot of skills developed, loyalty.
And loyalty goes both ways. Good wages, $45,000 to $70,000 US dollars a year for the average factory job, keep Mathis's workers loyal to his company. And those workers' skills and experience keep Mathis loyal to them. He says even if he could hire workers for less money in other countries, he's not tempted to outsource. It could compromise the quality of his products.
The package we are selling is very depending on the good, skilled workers we have got. And I think 20, 30 years of experience you cannot replace easily.
And do you think that will have to change because of competition?
I hope not.
And that decision not to outsource, as tempting as it might sound in the short run, because it wouldn't pay in the long run, that's the kind of thinking that brings us to the second principle that's helped Mathis Menzel's factory succeed, as well as the larger German economy, long-term thinking. Mathis Menzel says because his company is family-owned, like a lot of German Mittelstand companies, he's not beholden to shareholders' short-term quarterly demands. He can think in terms of decades, not quarters.
That's why Germany's economy is so much stronger than all the other Europeans, actually, because we are not depending on next week's bank's decisions. This gives you a more stable long-term orientation.
And you can see that stable long-term orientation in every aspect of Mathis's factory, down to the way the buildings are laid out. As we walk from workshop to workshop...
Careful, mind the step.
Thank you. You notice that the factory isn't one fancy modern building they suddenly spent a lot of money on. It's a series of small brick structures, frugally built, one by one, over the years.
You see, I think this is also quite typical. Whenever there was some money left, there was the next building built, like most of the German companies.
You don't do it all at once. You save and you...
It's the usual way over the decades. Because
as Mathis is talking, I keep finding myself staring at that scar on the bridge of his nose. And I finally have to ask him about it. He tells me he got it recently when he was punched in the face. I'll explain why in a minute. But first, let's turn to BBC business reporter Simon Jack for a closer look at that German obsession with stability, thrift, and especially balancing the books. He's been hearing how those same qualities that propped up the strength of the old Deutschmark could now rip apart the euro.
Thanks, Chrissy. All those things that you just heard about Mathis's factory and how it embodies the principle that built Germany's success, that's just one part of the story. The truth is that the German post-war economic miracle, or Wirtschaftswunder, is based on a little fact that few know and even fewer want to acknowledge. It started with debt forgiveness for Germany in the 1950s. I put that idea to Marcel Fratscher, the rising star of German economics.
So in a way, the German strength now is in part built on debt forgiveness in the past.
Yes, absolutely, but no one likes to remember that in Germany. Germany doesn't even like to remember that Germany was a sick man of Europe 10 years ago. So certainly people don't want to remember what happened in 1953. Germany was forgiven a lot of its debt. So There's hardly any discussion on that in Germany. Those that know about it reply to you, well, it was different because Germany had good institutions and the money was spent wisely by the German government. And the question is indeed whether the money is spent wisely by the Greek government today.
The irony here is that today, Germany is now in the position to forgive Greece's debt. But so far, Germans seem reluctant to do for Greece what was done for them in the 1950s. I asked Marcel to help me understand Germany's relationship to debt.
The German word for debt is very close to the word for guilt. So if you take on debt, you take on guilt. You're guilty of doing something. And that it describes, I think, the attitude quite well. Germans have the view that before you make an investment or before you spend money, you need to earn it.
That feeling runs deep and is even shared among young Germans, as I discovered when I asked them what they would do with €1 million. Holiday of a lifetime, new clothes, a flash new car, no chance.
I think I would save them for times when I really need the money, so I have some. Yeah.
Oh, that's difficult. I wouldn't stop working, that's for sure.
Based on my conversations with people on the street, it was beginning to look like the stereotypes about Germans being very risk-averse and pragmatic were accurate. I wanted to dig a little deeper with Stefan Schneider, chief economist at Deutsche Bank. He says he's got the research to back it up.
I know that it almost sounds like a stereotype, but if you look into psychological research or into financial behavior research, you will find actually these kind of stereotypes supported. And I think you can see that also in the behavior. And if they look at some measures of risk proneness or risk aversion, the Germans score very highly in terms of risk aversion. And you can see that in their savings behavior.
So the stereotypes are all true?
Unfortunately, or fortunately, to a certain extent, they are.
But those stereotypes may be changing. And to tell that part of the story, it's back to Chrissy again.
It's 9 p.m. and I'm at a kickboxing studio next to the airport on the outskirts of Berlin. This is where Mathis Menzel, the owner of the motor factory, got that scar on his nose. He was punched in the face during kickboxing training. Mathis comes here once a week for what the Germans call Feierabend.
You're laughing.
That's a typical German word, yeah.
It's a good word. It translates to fun.
Or celebrate evening. Celebrate evening is more the correct translation.
Tonight, Mathis' sparring partner is a kickboxing lipstick salesman who, like Mathis, is a business owner.
Hi, my name is Jan Miem. I am co-pilot at Uslu Airlines. Uslu Airlines is not an airline, and I'm actually not really a pilot. You could call me a co-founder or co-CEO of a Berlin-based cosmetic brand.
Both Mathis and Jan's businesses are flourishing because of the rise of developing nations. But the similarities between Jan and Mathis pretty much end there. The loud, dirty, high-tech factory where Mathis's workers build motors is the exact opposite of the headquarters of Jan's company, Uslu Airlines.
Hey, Chris.
Hi.
The day after kickboxing, I visit Uslu Airlines. It's located on a top-floor penthouse apartment in former East Berlin in a neighborhood called Mitte, which is a hub for Berlin's startup scene.
So, okay, this is a very important room. This is the bathroom.
The space is filled with samples of the products they offer. Lipsticks, nail polishes, lip gloss, and their flagship product, a makeup airbrush system that looks like a model of a small silver spaceship.
I don't know, it feels like a nice old Mont Blanc pen, I like to say.
Farida Uslu, Jan's ex-wife, is the CEO of Uslu Airlines. They still run the company together. Farida turns on the machine and explains how it works.
You know, I will do my makeup now for you, and I only need like 3 drops.
Jan and Farida got the idea for the airbrush after using a clunky homemade version that Farida used at her job as a makeup artist. But there were some obstacles to starting this business. Neither Jan nor Farida had any credit, and they couldn't get a business loan. So they started their company in a very un-German way. They racked up more than $50,000 in debt on at least 10 different credit cards.
We took quite a bit of risk because when you start all this on maxed out credit cards, of course the interest rate is on you is exorbitant. It's criminal. And luckily,
we had an immediate pretty good success with this. The brand performed so well.
That was 12 years ago. Today, Uslu's grown to a company with 7 employees, and its products are available in a handful of countries all over the world. Jan and Farida are doing well.
I'm a typical immigrant child. My parents are Turkish. I moved to Germany when I was 6. So already there, you have it somehow planted in your mind. You go to a different country to have a better living.
Farida says her family found that better living in Germany. In both of their jobs, Farida's parents earned a small pension. Today, they're retired, living back in Turkey.
They have their house, they have their little garden. They don't live in luxury, but they have everything they wanted. But the difference is they worked for that, for their pension. I don't have that.
Pensions, stable jobs. Farida and Jan can't really imagine those things in their own lives.
Like my parents' attitude, okay, you go to school, you do well in school, then you go to college, then you acquire a job, and this is the company you stay with, and then you retire. I think those times are entirely over.
And that's not just what Jan and Farida think, as Simon Jack discovered on the streets of Frankfurt.
To get a sense of just how widespread this economic insecurity is, I went out on the streets to ask Germans how they feel about their economic future. And what you'll find is modest expectations.
I think we need not much money to be rich. We are rich when we have much love and the family.
Personally, I think they all dream from their own house. They don't want to have a flat for rent. Very basic.
Very basic. And a good job?
Good job, good money.
What would you like to be when you grow up?
Customs officer.
Really?
Really.
You want to be a customs officer?
Yeah.
If the dreams of Germans are modest, what do they expect for future generations? What economic opportunities do they see in their children's future? I put this question to Professor Peter Bofinger. He's one of Angela Merkel's Council of Five Wise Men, who advise her on all things economic.
Do you think your children will be better off than you?
Well, I don't think that one can generalize this. I think most people are not sure that their children will be in a better position than they are, that it will be difficult for the children to have lifetime jobs. Without lifetime jobs, it might be even more difficult to own a house. And so I think the average expectation in Germany is certainly not the expectation it will be getting better and better. I think it's just the opposite. Hopefully things will stay as they are.
But the economic situation in Germany is changing, and that may lead to a new generation of Germans who kick against the old stereotypes about being uncomfortable with debt or risk-averse. In Berlin, I'm Simon Jack for the BBC.
And I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace. Next week, we visit Nigeria. And you can check out more content from the series at marketplace.org. Also, tweet us. What are your economic aspirations? Let us know by using the hashtag 6Roots. That's the number 6, R-O-U-T-E-S.